For more information on ancient dragon Zen Gate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
The unsurpassed profound and wondrous Dharma is rarely met with even in 100,000 million kalpas. Now I can see and hear and maintain it. May I unfold the meaning of the Tathagata's truth.
Good morning, and thank you all for braving the blizzard to be here on a Sunday morning. I'm very happy to have giving the talk this morning Asian Nancy Easton, who is one of the founders of Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and currently the Tenzo, formerly director and board member. And thank you, Asian, for speaking this morning.
Oh, you built me up too much.
But thank you. I'm happy to be here. And, that made it sound like I really know what I'm talking about, but I don't know. You know, this talk actually it's a little bit of a hodgepodge of things that have been rolling around in my consciousness for the past couple months. I said that I would be speaking on just the saying or the phrase, "The entire universe is one bright pearl." I said that last week because somebody said it. And that wasn't what I was thinking I was going to be talking about until somebody actually said the sentence, and then I realized that is actually what I want to talk about. What I thought I wanted to talk about was the Song of the Grass Hut. But what I have to say, I think, can be encompassed very well by the idea that the whole universe is one bright pearl. And that phrase comes up at least two times that I'm aware of in Zen literature. So there's a koan, and they're in the Shobo Genzo in particular by Dogen. He refers to this koan, although he refers to another part of the koan. And it is a based on the great master Gensha Shibi, or I think it's Xuansha Shipe. I always kind of massacre people's Chinese names. Who said he had attained the way and said to people, "The whole world in all 10 directions is a single bright pearl." Now, in the Thomas Cleary translation that I have of Dogen, he actually says one bright jewel, and I'm gonna talk about that a little bit. It's funny because I was thinking about talking about this, and then I was not thinking that when I woke up, the entire Chicagoland area would look like one bright pearl. But it does, and with, 9 more inches of snow expected this afternoon, it might continue to look like one bright pearl for at least a couple days. And I think, everybody, we always like when it snows, because the snow kind of obscures all of the things that we don't want to see. And that is not at all what I mean by the idea that the whole world is a single bright pearl. But, I'll get to that in a minute. So I'm going to read you just one paragraph from what Dogen talks about this koan. He says, after he, Gensha, had finally attained the way, he said to people, "The whole world in all 10 directions is a single bright jewel." Then a monk asked, "I hear you have a saying that the whole world in all 10 directions is one bright jewel. How can a student understand this?" The master said, "The whole world in all 10 directions is one bright jewel. What does it have to do with understanding?" The next day, the master asked that monk, "The whole world in all 10 directions is one bright jewel. How do you understand?" The monk replied, "The whole world in all 10 directions is one bright jewel. What does it have to do with understanding?" And the master said, "I knew you were making a living in a ghost cave in the mountain of darkness." And what he means by that is, you are stuck in emptiness or in unknowing. You're just repeating back to me what I said. You can't just be stuck in one position or in a cliche. You have to find some way of bringing this to life in your life. You can't just repeat back what you were told. And so I'm going to be drawing on a couple different things that I have noticed recently that kind of maybe will elucidate, you know, how the whole world is one bright pearl. So what is a pearl? Everybody knows what a pearl looks like, right? More or less. It's actually a hard object made of calcium carbonate that's produced in the soft tissue of a mollusk, purposely or otherwise. It's usually round, but sometimes there are different, you know, kind of shapes. And unlike a jewel, you know, unlike one bright jewel, a jewel has many facets, and we can maybe think of the whole, maybe it's easier to think of the whole world as being one bright jewel because we can think, okay, you know, so I'm looking at this facet right now, but the other one is obscured, or, you know, the facets are reflecting all the different things. Pearls can seem very smooth and impenetrable and kind of opaque, and it's hard to get a handle on, you know, what that is. It's not reflecting something, you know, directly back at us. And, you know, I think the universe can sort of seem this way at times. You know, we maybe have a tendency to think of the entire universe as being out there plus me, you know, something additional, which is, you know, sort of additional or separate or in here. And, you know, we can see ourselves as acting on the world versus acting as part of the world. We don't always, you know, we sometimes think about there being subjects and objects. You know, we do something or, you know, say something or do something with something versus subject and subject, where I'm a subject and I've interacted with each of you here, and I know that you are all subjects. And sometimes we can be subjects together. Sometimes we can treat other people as objects, but they're really subjects, and actually all things are subjects. They're interacting with us. There's a phrase that's come up in my life as a bike commuter where we talk about, you know, we complain about the traffic, but we forget that we are the traffic. And that is how I want to think about this. You know, in reality, we operate on the environment, but the environment operates on us. We do things together with all beings. And recently, I have been just kind of living my life and coming up and reading things in the news. And the things that I'm reading in the news are like, sometimes they just jump out at me like, wow, that is really what I'm trying to say here. So I am going to just kind of give you a brief synopsis of two news articles that I found this month. This one is from NPR, January 5th. The title of the news article is "What Heroin Addiction Tells Us About Changing Bad Habits." And I don't really want to talk about bad habits, but the point of the article is it's based on a study that was conducted in Vietnam towards the end of the Vietnam War using American servicemen. In May of 1971, two congressmen went to Vietnam for an official visit and returned with some very disturbing news, which is that it seemed to them that about 15% of U.S. servicemen in Vietnam were actively addicted to heroin. And so they set up a comprehensive system so that every enlisted man was tested for heroin addiction before he was allowed to return home. And in this population at this time, they did find high rates of addiction, and it turned out that actually about 20% of the soldiers were self-identifying as heroin addicts. And so they say that those who were addicted were kept in Vietnam until they dried out. When these soldiers finally did return to their lives back in the U.S., Robbins tracked them, collecting data at regular intervals. And this is where the story takes a curious turn. According to her research, the number of soldiers who continued their heroin addiction once they returned to the U.S. was shockingly low, and it was, in fact, about 5%. And what they said, 95% of the people who were addicted in Vietnam did not become re-addicted when they returned to the United States. They got some brief intervention, they returned to their lives, they did not return to heroin use. This flew in the face of everything everyone knew, both about heroin and about drug addiction generally. When addicts were treated in the U.S. and returned to their homes, relapse rates hovered around 90%. So it didn't make sense to them. They devised some theories, and I'm just going to summarize this. They discovered that once a behavior has been repeated a lot, especially if somebody does it in the same setting, it's very hard to change. But people's behavior does not necessarily follow their intentions. They might want to stop something. They might not. It's very hard to change sometimes, especially something that has become a very compelling behavior to the point of addiction. And they said, the theory is that they developed was that people, when they perform a behavior a lot, especially in the same environment, same sort of physical setting, outsource the control of the behavior to the environment. They describe this as something that people are, sort of actively doing, whether consciously or unconsciously. But what they compare it to, the act of getting into a car. When you first get into a car, everything seems unfamiliar. You have to, remember to adjust the rear view mirror and, pull the seat up and, what do I do next? Where are the wipers? Where are the lights? And they say, if you break it down, it's really a myriad set of complex actions that are performed in sequence that over time become automated and they begin to operate on us. And my main point is that they talk about, in this way, our environments come to unconsciously direct our behavior, even behaviors that we don't want, like, an addictive behavior or I'll leave it at that. Over time, these cues become so deeply ingrained that they're hard to resist. And so we smoke at the entrance of our work building because that's where we have to go to smoke, even when we don't want to. We sit on the couch and eat ice cream when we don't want to, despite our best intentions, despite our resolutions. We don't feel pushed by the environment, but in fact, we're very integrated in it. And so this article sort of closes with the sentences. We think of ourselves as controlling our behavior, willing our actions into being, but it's not that simple. It's as if, over time, we leave parts of ourselves all around us, which in turn come to shape who we are. There is a minute, and I mean, we hear this in, Zen teachings, that there are, minute ways in which we are just intimately affected by everything that we do, everything that, nature versus nurture, everything that has gone into making us who we are, continues to be part of us, even though we think of ourselves as independent agents. What do I want to say about this other one? I will just say that I found this other article that was from December in a magazine called Urban Land, the magazine of the Urban Land Institute. And they basically, their main point is that public health can benefit more from compact and connected street networks, which reduce a number of chronic diseases like obesity and heart disease, because we are walking more or biking more versus driving. They found that in places where there were high intersection density, a measure of compactness of neighborhoods, it significantly reduced the risk of obesity, diabetes, high blood pressure, and heart disease. And they are hoping that understanding this a little bit better will help to improve public health outcomes. They base it on something called the walk score of your neighborhood. If you're familiar with this, it's basically an index assigning a numerical walkability score to any address in the U.S. or Canada, and you get points for your address based on the distance to amenities like shopping, transit, schools, businesses, parks, theaters, and the higher your walk score, the more likely well, the more likely it is that you yourself will be walking to places. And that does have significant public health implications. There's also a bike score and a transit score. And so I actually, after I wrote this talk, I found something in class differences and how class differences determine health outcomes, also, which I will just not get into, but it's everywhere. We are not always, which I think I wanted to talk about this because I just wanted to raise the people's awareness of how these things are actively operating in our lives, you know, on a level below our awareness. So back to Zen and Dogen. And I actually wanted to talk a little bit about this concept as it appears in Genjo Koan. You know, now that I've talked about how we think of ourselves as independent agents and, you know, really we are doing things with the environment, one of the things that Dogen says in Genjo Koan is to carry yourself forward and experience myriad things as delusion, that myriad things come forth and experience themselves as awakening. You know, this doesn't mean that we are erasing ourselves, you know, that we're not just letting things sort of happen. We're not just, you know, going with the flow or being passive. We're not erasing our thoughts or preferences or actions. We're still agents in the process. We're still participating in the environment, and there's no real strategy. It's not that, you know, we can make things happen, but we are not in total control. And I think, you know, Zazen practice provides an opportunity for us to sit down in the middle of all these myriad things, not trying to change things inside or outside in any way, and just observing them. I was partly moved to write this talk because I've been in my own practice, I think kind of recently passing through a period of feeling pretty burnt out, you know, burnt out on practice, burnt out on work, just kind of showing up for things. Maybe other people have felt this way at times. And I think when we feel like this, there can be a tendency to feel that we should do something about it. And it's not always clear what that is. But actually what I have been discovering through, you know, just continuing to show up and continuing to sit, is that these feelings can transform on their own, and they can also transform us into something that we won't necessarily find if we try to do something. And the phrase that this brought me to was what I thought I was going to be talking about in the beginning, which was the line from the Song of the Grass Hut in which Shuto says, "Living here, he no longer works to get free." When we are living here, you know, meaning here, you know, not anywhere in particular, there's, you know, nowhere standing, there's nothing to grasp or cling to because everything is changing. We can't just grab onto the bright pearl. And in no longer working to get free, I think we're finding a way to sort of slowly accept interdependence and our own position within this. We can understand it intellectually, and then, you know, I felt like in reading some of these news articles and in, you know, sitting with things that I just didn't feel right and I didn't really know what to do about, you know, you can really come to sort of viscerally experience the feeling of interdependence and the impossibility of separating out from that. I think this is different from practicing Zazen in order to get something out of it, you know, peace or patience or whatever. It's not that there's anything wrong with wanting to get something out of it. And, you know, over time, I think many people do, in fact, become more peaceful or more patient or whatever. But over time, with, you know, continuous practice, I think it can become something that we just do without having a rationale or a reason. We it can be very un-American to think that we're just, you know, doing things for the sake of doing them or putting up with them. We should have reasons, you know, we should be doing things and we should agree with why we are doing them. But, you know, I think with practice, it helps to let go of some of that feeling of you know, sort of self-directed action. We can just do it and not be working to get free. You know, the world is really beyond our concepts and reasons. And so our perspective on what we should be doing or what we should be happening tends to be, you know, very limited, just limited to, you know, our own perspective. Right now, outside, the world does, in fact, look like one bright pearl. But, you know, that's just here on Irving Park Road. And I know in my mind that it isn't just this, you know, peaceful little you know, snow scene, that there is suffering even, you know, here in Chicago and in the wider world that we can't see right now, and it's still there, and it isn't always something that we can directly do something about, but acting in, you know, concert together with the environment, it is something that is just, it's continuing to work out. We're part of all of this. The last I think quote that I want to bring into this thought is a discussion is from Genjo Koan again by Dogen, and it's the line about when you first seek the Dharma, you imagine you are far away from its environs, but Dharma is already correctly transmitted. You are immediately your original self, you know. And if these actual, you know, news articles with scientific studies are to be believed, which we, I think, are often ordinarily rely on, your original self is much more vast and less under your personal control than it would seem at first glance. You know, our original self is maybe really very much so, you know, demonstrably more part of the environment than we normally see. You know, he then goes on to say, here is the place, here the way unfolds. This is the only place where you can bring some agency, you can bring practice, and you know, the universe is unfolding with us constantly. We are practicing with all sentient beings. We actually can't do it separately, as you know, I think the news is telling me, you know, even though we may not always see this. And so to practice, we need some faith or some trust. Not trust in something that we can hold on to or grasp, but trust in the ungraspable. Trust in the fact that the world, the entire world, is one bright pearl. We can, you know, maybe in practicing a little bit, we can try to loosen up or give up the idea that we can, you know, figure it out or do it ourselves. It's actually and experience a little bit more the way that it's actually already doing itself. And trust in this way allows us to, you know, loosen up our own self-agency a little bit and participate in that. You know, can we trust that the world and all beings and events will meet us in our life as our life? We, even things that we don't want to be happening or that we want to, you know, push away or, you know, let's keep it over here, it is our life. And it's meeting us. And I think that, you know, this, in this way, is what I think it means to realize that the entire universe is one bright pearl. So that's, I think, the didactic portion of my talk. I was hoping that we would have a little bit of discussion on, you know, someone last week said, from what I remember, you know, that we had the observation that we are notoriously bad at predicting who we will be or what we will do in the future. And I was thinking, you know, when she was saying that, you know, that's there's more evidence that is because the environment is operating on us. We're being exposed to things and we are moved to do something. And so I thought that maybe people would have examples of their awareness of how the environment is operating, you know, together with all of us. So that's all I want to say. Or if people have, you know, questions or comments other than my suggested discussion, that's okay too.
Thank you very much. This is very helpful to me. And Deborah said it last
week. Yeah. I wasn't going to name names.
Yeah, but it's very helpful to me because I think I fall into the hole often of trying to think through the value of what I'm doing or is how that relates to other things that need to be done at this point in time and doing this continual evaluation. And so then it makes it harder to change a practice, you know, that has to do with sitting or doing things that I want to get into a routine about.
Mm-hmm.
But that idea of that the environment is, you know, that we're acting on it and then we shape it and it gives us, it reflects back to us and tends to encourage certain behaviors because it's become routine. Mm-hmm. You know, like we were talking about cats earlier, I know my cat expects me to sit on the couch at some point in the evening after dinner and get on my lap. You know, it's like, it's part of the routine. I mean, that's just an example. So if I were to switch gears and clean house at that point in time, you know, it's just one little thing that encourages me to go to what I usually do.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You're reminding me of, I think it was Katagiri Roshi in the book, You Have to Say Something, talks about vow and how we have vows, but we actually have to make them real by developing habits. And it's hard to develop a habit. It's hard to break a habit mm-hmm. because it takes conscious work for a while, but then it becomes a habit and then it's part of us and it's, you know, maybe partly kind of boosted by our environment. But that's how we can, actually bring a vow to life. We can't just do it by thinking, oh, that's such a great thing. That's what I'm going to do. You know, it breaks down into sort of minute actions
that you do because
that we don't even notice.
You stop thinking, evaluating it. You do it because it's a vow, and you. You just let yourself go with that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
So in some ways, I feel like there's a thread in what you're saying about, and what you were both of you just talking about that has to do with the sense of agency and the extent to which just we as human beings, you know, how that operates in us, the extent to which we're able to choose to wake up or choose to be aware in a certain moment just of what's happening, and then from there actually have some more agency maybe available to us.
Yeah.
So that's sort of just the human, how we are kind of just as a species created, and like to what extent we're able to kind of access material that's otherwise unconscious. But the other realm that was coming up for me as you were talking was not human per se, it was the physical world, because I was, I've been watching the Cosmos, the new Cosmos series. Have people watched that?
I haven't seen it.
It's wonderful.
Yeah, it's on Netflix. I've just finished it, and I was like, it was like a religious experience for me. It was like, this is such a wonderful compliment to Buddhist approach. It's basically, you know, from the most micro of scales of sort of like subatomic, you know, aspect of our universe, to the largest, you know, the sense of like how big is this, you know, habit. And actually the idea that it all started, you know, before the Big Bang, that everything was, I forget the size, but it's like all matter and energy in the universe was compressed to this. It just was this small, I can't remember how big it was, and then with the Big Bang, it was at a size that was very palpable to us, basically. It would be like an understandable size. And then, you know, it became subatomic particles that started rotating around each other and becoming atoms. Okay. Mm-hmm. And over time, evolving, you know, you know, then into...
So like it started as energy, which
matter and energy,
then
whatever
developed into matter,
like
okay.
Thing. And then it burst into all that we know, but gradually became bodies of matter, of different types of matter. It became matter, became elements, what we now know as elements, and became planets, and anyway, and then the origin of life at some point, and then the origin of us at some point. So anyway, there was just this sense of inseparableness, you know, that expression of we're all made of stardust was like, yeah, we are, you know, there's just no separation.
Yeah. And that's what I like about the idea of One Bright Pearl. It's not very intuitive, but it kind of speaks to how we are all made up of the same stuff, even though it can look so very different.
There's no concrete separation. And what was the other word? The pearl made me think about inside. Oh, the effect, things affecting each other was how cosmic rays... which come from these explosions in space and then shoot through space and come into our bodies and like or shoot through us and sometimes cause some of the genetic
mutations.
Oh. Yeah, part of how evolution is happening, how we even come to be, is because of these rays coming through. And if there were more of them coming through because of the atmosphere being different, we wouldn't have been able to exist because of evolution couldn't have happened at the pace that it happened to allow us to adapt to our environments over time. So anyway, it's just this really humbling, you know, sense of
It didn't have to be this way.
Right.
Yeah. It makes us a little, you know, pulls you a little bit out of that sort of sense of like, okay, there's the entire universe and then there's me and everything was leading to this point.
Yeah.
Everything was leading to this point, but it could have led to a different point.
Yeah, it's just sort of a miracle.
Yeah.
So, thank you.
Thank you.
Douglas.
I appreciated you talking about how we can have that sense of staleness sometimes in practicing life, and I think, you know, it's hard to think about the fact that too is part of the one bright pearl, that each point in time or each point in space is part of the bright pearl. And in Shobo Genza, Duggan twists the koan a little bit of when he says the whole universe is one bright pearl. What is your understanding?
Yeah.
Says what's the point of your understanding? And again, Dogen sort of twists that, and the monk comes back the next day and says, the whole universe is one bright pearl. What do you do with your understanding? And the teacher comes back and says, well, now I see you've made your way out of the demon cave on the dark mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that part of that is, you know, it's not, you'll have the understanding, but it's not going to feel like one bright pearl all the time.
Right.
You have to take each of those moments seriously. And sort of from last week, in part of One Bright Pearl, Duggan comes back and says, you know, there's Moonface Buddha, Sunface Buddha, Moonface Buddha, and they don't switch places. Sunface Buddha emerges as Sunface, emerges as Sunface, Moonface emerges as Moonface.
Mm-hmm.
You have to deal with each of those moments and each how you feel at any one moment.
Sometimes,
the expression of the bright pearl.
Sometimes I think we have something to learn in a situation and we don't see it and we don't really want to, and we think, well, there's something wrong with this situation because it's not working the way I think it should. And we don't always see that the point is that we have something to kind of pass through, or we're coming maybe sometimes up against that impasse because there's something about us that is needing to change that doesn't feel like it needs to change. But that's, you know, the only way to sort of transcend, I think, is to sort of sit through it. Yeah. And what do you do with that understanding?
Well, it's like every situation is a Dharma gate, an opportunity.
Yeah.
And yeah, the way you just said it was, I think, really good, that that we have to look and see what to do in each situation. I think it applies collectively too, in all the problems that in our society, in our world, are for us collectively as human beings opportunities to actually work through something that we need that needs to be worked through. So, but yeah, it doesn't always look like a bright pearl.
No, and
I appreciate it also. You're talking about that feeling of staleness, is, you know, one way to put it. I don't know if you want to if you could say something more about that, or how that is for you to emerge from.
Well, I mean, it was horrible. It was horrible to feel, and it just felt like I should just quit, you know? As when I first started practicing, I quit a lot of times. All the time, you know? And I mean, like one time to the point where I threw away my Zafu and Zabaton, I just put them out in the trash because I felt like, well, this is stupid. Why? This is pointless. And then, you know, later on, I'd be like, I do kind of want to do that. Or I wanted to believe that it wasn't stupid and pointless. And so I would start again and, you know, get a new Zafu and Zabaton. I threw away my books. I had to buy all those again. But this time was like, you know, you can always come up, maybe that's the thing, you can always come up with a perfectly good reason for why you feel the way you feel right now and why you should, you know, change your course. And it feels just, there are long periods of time of like, why am I doing this? Why do I go here every week? Why, you know, why do I sit every day? What's the point of this? And no hope, you know, that was going to be different. It's not like, you know, you've gone through it. Now I can look back at my early days of Zazen and be like, okay, yeah, I made it through that. But, you know, when you're going through it, it doesn't feel like I'm just going through a phase, except that part of me was like, I think that this has to be some kind of predictable phase or something. This has to be something that people go through in their practice that we just don't talk about. And it didn't help that we were reading, you know, the Dashabhumika chapter in the Avalokiteshvara, the Avatamsaka Sutra, where we're talking about, you know, beings who are experiencing intense joy. They're in the phase of joy, and I'm like, I don't like this. You know, you go through a period of this is not for me, and I didn't know that I was coming out of it until I just noticed that I stopped feeling so bad. And I had energy to do stuff, and I was, you know, picking up more stuff at work and doing more to try to help my coworkers without, you know, keeping score about who had been helping who. And I don't, you know, I can't say that I'm really out of it because I haven't even really, you know, thought about it. But who knows? Who knows where any of us is at any point? But it is very hard to continue to bring yourself to something that you can't justify as the right thing to do. I'll just say that. And yet, practice has become what I do. So it wasn't that I felt like, yeah, this is practice will get me through this, or practice will be a good thing to do in the middle of this. It was just like, no, you know, that's what you do at 7 a.m. as you sit down. So that was it. That's all I have to say.
Thank you, Aishin. Other comments? Or maybe I should call on Paula, who's just returned from intensive period of practice.
Yeah, no, and welcome, great enlightenment.
Welcome home. And I don't know, do you have any reflections or comments or anything that Aishin's been saying?
I think the interdependence of everything is kind of where I'm at. I have not yet hit a period of practice where I felt it was stale, because I think there's always been something new. And I can relate to my martial art practice, but even with Shaolin, you know, I feel this way actually about the Zazen and the trappings of the things around the Zazen. With the Shaolin practice, if things get stale, there's always another aspect of the practice in which you could study. So, for example,
if I'm doing open hand forms and I'm doing the same form over and over again and I just can't stand to do it another time because it seems like I'm not learning something or it's boring and my mind's going to snap because I've done the same repetition, then I could do sparring or practical self-defense and still get some elements from the form in that, but it's a different practice.
Mm-hmm.
So with this practice, I see like the sutras and the ritual practice and the zazen all complement each other, but if I get tired of zazen, then I might do more reading, for example. I don't tend to read a lot. So for me, it's like, oh, well, maybe I'll look at a sutra now and really try and understand it. So in that way, it helps me when things start to feel stale.
That's, you know, that was sort of one conclusion that I came to at some point, not for better or for worse, but I just came to the point where I felt like, you know, there's nothing wrong with wanting something new. You know, the thing, I mean, if things are changing all the time, why should my practice always be, you know, the same? You know, what's wrong with wanting something new or passing through something that feels important for a while and doesn't? And I think, you know, the one thing that remained constant is that I just continued to practice in some way. I didn't just, you know, walk away and throw everything away.
One thing, though, that stuck out when you started talking about the vow in relation to environment is the discipline.
Yeah.
That there's a certain element of discipline, like Kathy, you brought it up also, that applies to making something, making a vow actually happen. So I think that's kind of important.
One aspect that comes up in your dialogue is that part of what it does happen that we get into routines. It was interesting what you were saying about routines and how our routines are basically affected and impacted and in some sense directed by our surroundings. And that's really, really interesting. But when we hit a period where it feels like we're doing the same thing over and over and over again, and I'm going to talk about Groundhog Day tomorrow night, but you know, one of the things that we can do is to, I don't know if this is a funny way of saying it, to entertain ourselves. If there's something that feels routine and we feel tired or feels boring or whatever it is, there's a way of looking at it from a different angle that then allows us to feel like, oh, you know, like what you were saying, Paul, about switching from, you know, reading something to sitting or vice versa. How do we keep ourselves interested in being present? And so that's a part of that is actually kind of one of the knacks or crafts of practice is to, when it feels yucky and we don't feel like doing it, what is there going on that we can look at and see a different way? And, you know, so you have, there has to be some intention to do that, but to make it fresh.
You can't have, there's no strategy, you know, you just can't have a strategy. You just have to have, you partly have to have some intention or vow, but you also have to have, I think you have to kind of let yourself work with it.
Yeah.
And not just impose it on yourself. But it does require discipline and some deep intention beyond even, you know, what I thought I had.
And then, you know, the thing about the environment is partly we can benefit from listening in a different way. So all of the situations and our routines and our physical environment affects what we're doing, as you were saying. And so another, you know, I want to say a trick, but, you know, it's another way of keeping our interest is to allow oneself to be affected by our standard routine surroundings, but maybe, you know, just move a little bit, let it hit us in a different way. And there's something, when we study something really closely, Dogen's always saying, study this thoroughly, you know, and it's not just being obsessive. It's like if you look at something and else, you know, closely, you have a chance to see something differently.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, anyway, we can use that as a way of...
Which may have implications for then what you know about it.
Yeah.
Or may not.
Yeah, even if we don't know completely, at least, you know, there's something fresh. So finding the freshness, to use that word, or the newness or the strangeness of some situation may help us to proceed in a different way. Anyway, I want to thank you very much. Wonderful talk, really interesting for all of us.
Next time you read the news, see what you see. See what you find.